Roby added, "If so, they're beyond help." I would have to agree with that. Any attempt to free them would create an international incident that we cannot afford at present.
He said to protect his family. Well, we failed him on that.
We were talking retaliation, said Roby quickly, noting Reel's depressed look. Blue Man nodded and opened a file on his desk. It's why I called you two in, really. Now the DCI...
Is he still in denial?
Apparently so. Head in the sand, hoping the other shoe does not drop.
Great plan.
Perhaps. But options are limited. Surely we can take some defensive measures, said Roby. We can and are, replied Blue Man.
We feel that since our target was at the highest level in North Korea, any retaliatory action on their part will be aimed at the same level here.
Roby looked doubtful. The president? They have to realize they can't get close to him. The Secret Service has been made aware of the need for heightened protection, although the president already enjoys the best protection in the world.
So if not the president, what then?
The vice president? The Speaker of the House? A prominent cabinet secretary? A Supreme Court justice, perhaps? Maybe even a dirty bomb in a populous area? And the target would be largely symbolic, and the message would be, we can get to your leaders or people anytime we want. It would definitely be a blow to this country should they succeed. But what's the endgame on this? Asked Roby. After they strike back, Pyongyang may release to the world whatever evidence they have about a plot led by this country to assassinate their leader. The world won't believe the North Koreans. They hardly have credibility, Roby pointed out. But in this case, they would be telling the truth, wouldn't they? And we don't know what they might have discovered. From Pak or Lloyd Carson? The DCI doesn't think there is anything there, but his judgment has not been infallible.
Quite the opposite.
Roby said, you didn't call us in here to tell us to do nothing. No, I wanted to warn you, said Blue Man.
About what?
At the cottage where you saw Pak kill himself?
Yeah,
said Roby warily. You may have been seen.
That's impossible. We didn't see anyone, and our surveillance cameras showed no activity.
Nevertheless, the rumblings we're hearing indicate you may have been seen, and if so, you may become targets as well. Roby looked over at Reel. Well, it won't be the first time. Although I think I'd take the neo-Nazis over the North Koreans.
Chapter 53 President Tom Cassian sat at the breakfast table in his family's private quarters in the White House. He'd already been given his daily briefing and was fortifying himself with an extra cup of coffee before truly beginning his day, which was mapped out to the minute. He looked across the table at his wife Eleanor, or Ellie, as he and her closest friends called her.
"I saw your schedule for the next couple of days," he said, folding up a copy of the Washington Post and setting it next to his largely uneaten breakfast. "Pretty busy." She looked over her teacup at him.
"Right, and I saw yours. Pretty empty. What a slacker."
He smiled resignedly. "It's not that bad." She glanced at all the food left on his plate.
"You haven't been eating lately, Tom."
"Stomach's been a little unsettled, just under the weather."
"Go see the doctor, then. You have your own private one."
He nodded. "I will," he said, vaguely staring off.
"When do you get back?"
"Four stops. Seattle, San Francisco, Houston, and Miami. Air Force One wheels down tomorrow afternoon at 2:00.
"Sort of like the campaign."
"Not nearly as busy. How many times did we travel to 8 or 10 cities in a single day?"
"Too many times."
"And these days politicians never stop campaigning. With the changes in the laws, any amount of money can be thrown into the ring. You have to make certain you get your share of it, because the other side certainly will take up any slack."
"I miss the days of printing our own campaign flyers and collecting checks and a coffee can at backyard barbecues."
"Sometimes I do, too."
He ran his gaze over Eleanor as she went back to studying her schedule for the day. She was still young, 46, 4 years younger than he was. They had two kids, Claire and Tommy Jr. Claire was 15 going on 40. She had adapted extremely well to the life they now had. She made many friends at school and was active and popular at Sidwell Friends and a very good student. Tommy was still very much a little boy who had at first loved living in the White House, but had quickly grown to hate it. Neither the president nor his wife really knew what to do about it, and their son's unhappiness was weighing heavily on both of them. Eleanor's voice broke through these thoughts.
The kids have a week off from school soon. I was thinking about taking them out of town, maybe Nantucket. The Donovans have offered the house again.
He gaped at her. Nantucket? At this time of year? It'll be cold and rainy.
Actually, the average high is nearly 70 degrees, and the average low is over 50. And weather forecasts say precipitation levels will be well below average, although skies will probably be overcast. The Atlantic Ocean helps moderate the climate. It'll be warmer there than in Boston.
As usual, I see you've done your homework, Ellie, said the president grudgingly. She smiled.
And the tourists are all gone. It will be private, and we can regroup as a family. Toasty fires, curling up with a good book, playing board games, taking walks together on the beach, just recharging, getting to spend time with the kids.
You mean spending time with Tommy? Claire is doing just fine.
I mean as a family. And while I know your schedule is packed, it would be wonderful if you could come for at least a day.
The president looked at her strangely. Their lives were all governed by phone book-thick itineraries with travel mapped out well in advance. Is this on the schedule? I didn't see it.
No, I was just thinking about doing it.
Well, I seriously doubt I'll be able to come for even a day. My schedule is packed for the next 2 months, and besides, the voters don't like presidents to just pop off to vacations. You'll have to check with the Secret Service. They'll need time to prepare. It might be too difficult on such short notice.
I've already got them working on it.
Okay. Hope it works out. But I think you're overreacting to Tommy's issues. He just needs more time to settle in, that's all. He picked up his newspaper. Eleanor sighed, started to say something, and then returned to her tea and schedule, looking over notes for a speech she was set to deliver after a tour of the White House she was giving to a group of senators' spouses. The president did not seem to notice his wife's disappointment. His stomach was unsettled for one simple reason. Guilt. Massive, unrelenting guilt. He had given his word to General Pack that he would carry through on all that they had planned. He had said this to Pack, face to face, and now the man was dead. The president had actually sent agents out to kill him, but Pack had taken his own life and had told the agents to be sure to tell him, go to hell. If the positions had been reversed, the president would have done the same thing. He had betrayed the man, pure and simple. And now he had been told that Pack's adopted children had probably been sent to the labor camps, most likely for the rest of their lives. I betrayed the man. I killed the man. I'm guilty of murder.
Dad? Dad?
The president shook his head and glanced around. His daughter Claire had come down to breakfast.
I wanted you to look at the term paper I did for American Gov class.
You think I know anything about government? He said, attempting a weak smile.
No, but Mom is obviously busy.
She retorted with a broad smile. He laughed while Eleanor looked on amused. Then he continued to proudly watch as his daughter dug into her breakfast while scanning notes for what looked like her math class. He watched wearily as his son shuffled into the room wearing his school uniform. The boy had gone from a public school to one of the most elite institutions in the country. The transition had not been without some hiccups. Hey, big guy, said the president. Sleep okay? I'm not a big guy. I'm the smallest kid in my class. Even the girls are taller than me. Claire put her spoonful of cereal down and cracked.
And smarter, too.
Shut up! Exclaimed Tommy.
Claire,
said her mother sharply.
Leave it alone.
Claire smiled triumphantly and returned to her notes. The president said, Tommy, I'm 6'2". Your mother is 5'9". You're going to be tall. Simple matter of genetics. I bet in a couple of years you'll shoot right past your sister. You just have to be patient. Claire snorted, and Tommy scowled. And we have 3 more years in this place, said Tommy. Whoopee.
7 more when Dad wins re-election,
pointed out Claire gleefully.
Right, Dad?
The president was staring at his son and didn't answer her. Eleanor quickly rose, did an inspection of Tommy's appearance, and went into full-scale mom mode, tidying his hair, tucking in his shirt, redoing his tie, and smoothing down his collar.
You're running a little late,
she said.
Better hurry with your breakfast.
Tommy plopped down and stared glumly at his plate. Eleanor glanced quickly at her husband, but he had returned to gazing off. She had resigned herself after a bit of kicking and screaming that so long as they were in this house and he held his office, he was mostly gone from them. The problems he had to deal with were too immense, the vitriol too intense, the stakes too high. She felt like a single mother, but she had lots of help, and she was well aware that there were many women who were truly single, struggling to raise families with far fewer resources than she had. Still, it wasn't easy. Family was hard, regardless of how much money one had. But seeing his son had given the president something to think about. Family. He rose and dropped his napkin on his plate. Eleanor looked up at him.
Are you okay?
Just forgot something I needed to do before I fly out. He rushed off. Eleanor turned her attention back to Tommy and coaxed him into eating a few bites of his breakfast. Then she watched her children head off with their Secret Service protection details. They would drop Tommy off first and then Claire. A Secret Service agent would remain in the classroom with them throughout the day. As the motorcade rolled off, Eleanor did not notice the group of tourists congregating near the side gate to the White House. The place where the first family would leave and enter the White House was very private and not really visible to the public. Most of the public. A man and a woman held up their cameras and were snapping pictures of everything they could see. They had sought positions that would give them the best view into this private area, while the guards at this location were deliberately distracted by queries asked by others in their group. As the motorcade turned onto the street, another member of the group took pictures of it, smiling and waving and looking excited as a tourist might. He kept snapping pictures of the motorcade until it disappeared from sight. Then the tail was taken up by a pair of sedans that were parked on 17th Street. They worked in tandem, turning off and then coming back, so as not to make the Secret Service grow suspicious. Back at the White House, Eleanor had stopped to look at some plant beds being worked on by the grounds crew. As she stood there, her secretary came up to her.
Mrs. Cassian, I'm checking out the details for the trip to Nantucket for you. It'll be just you and the children, correct? Yes, I talked to the president this morning. It doesn't look like he can make it. The Secret Service are working on the logistics, and they'll have their preliminary report back later this week, if that's okay?
Eleanor nodded and said,
I remember the day when we just jumped into the car with a couple of suitcases and our dog and drove off.
The secretary laughed.
Wish those days were back? Only every minute of my life. But I really think it'll be good to get away. I only wish the president could join us. The house you've picked looks beautiful. Friends of ours, the Donovans, they're letting us use it. Very old, very rustic. We can walk to the beach, and we can ride bikes to town. Roaring fires, books to read, chats to have. Just being together. Sounds idyllic. I'm hoping that Tommy will like it.
The secretary nodded knowingly.
It's hard for kids. I don't think I could do it. Well, we have to figure out a way that allows Tommy to deal with it. We have no other choice.
As the pair walked back inside, a man in the uniform of the National Park Service rose from the planting bed he had been working on. Officially, he was from South Korea and had worked here for 6 years. In reality, he was North Korean and had been sent to the United States 15 years ago with the sole task of being assigned to the White House in some capacity. Many occupations for him had been ruled out, but working the grounds had not. And after working far harder than anyone else around him, he had made it here. He had been sending back regular reports to his government of any details here that may seem worthwhile. Not that much had been worthwhile, however. Until now. Now, he might have just hit the motherlode. Chapter 54. Roby and Real had been heading back to Roby's apartment after their meeting with Blue Man when they received an urgent summons from him to come immediately to the White House. They were escorted through security with record speed and led to the Situation Room complex's small conference room. It was unusual for people like them to be allowed in here, but they had been told that the president was going out of town that morning and needed to meet quickly and in relative secrecy. Blue Man was already there when they arrived. He had phoned them on the way in.
"Care to brief us before the man arrives?"
said Real. "I'm as much in the dark as you," admitted Blue Man. "I don't believe this went through official channels. I was surprised to get the call."
"Meaning spur of the moment," observed Roby.
"I was told spur of the breakfast. At least that's when the president apparently had an epiphany that he now wants to discuss with us."
"And not Evan Tucker? He's still DCI, for better or worse. Well, worse, actually."
"I don't believe he is attending, no. In fact, it seems his days at CIA may be numbered."
"And he asked for us, specifically?"
said Real, taking a seat next to Blue Man while Roby hovered near the door. Blue Man spread his hands. "You would not be here otherwise, nor would I. This is not a place you get to visit unless summoned."
Real abruptly stood, as did Blue Man, when President Cassian strode into the room, alone. One of his aides shut the door behind him after a resentful look at the other occupants of the room. Apparently the president's team was not pleased about being cut out of this meeting. Cassian said, "Thank you for coming. I don't have much time, so let's get down to it." He sat, and so did the others. "To the point. We have learned that General Pack had an adopted son and daughter. They're now grown. They have been sent to a labor camp within North Korea in retaliation for what Pack did." He stopped talking for a moment as the others stared pointedly at him. Cassian first looked at Real and then at Roby. "You were sent to France to kill Pack. I know this. You didn't have to carry out that assignment because he committed suicide in your presence."
"That's correct, sir," said Roby.
"And his last words were to tell me to go to hell."
Real nodded, but said nothing.
"And to save his family," added the president.
"Yes," said Roby. "It's all in our report."
The president sat back with a resigned air. "The fact of the matter is I'm thoroughly ashamed of myself for what happened. I sat in this very room and gave General Pack my word that I would not abandon him no matter what happened. I did not keep my word. On the contrary, I authorized his death."
"Conditions change, Mr. President," said Blue Man. "Nothing is inviolate in the world anymore, unfortunately."
Cassian said heatedly, "Well, a person's word should be. A president's word should be." He bit down on his thumb and seemed lost in thought. None of the others interrupted this. He finally said, "This may seem like a sudden inspiration on my part, but it's really not. It's something I've been kicking around in my head for some time now." He sat forward, his features filled with determination.
"I want a team to liberate Pack's family and bring them back here, where we will grant them full asylum."
A full minute of silence went by as Roby and Real stared back at their commander-in-chief. When Roby glanced at Blue Man, he looked stunned. Roby stared back at the president.
What sort of team?
I don't think I can send in the United States Army without doing more harm than good, replied Cassian, staring fixedly back at him.
So, a small team.
Blue Man said, Do we even know which labor camp they're in? There are quite a few.
That's why we have the best intelligence agencies in the world. I've asked for and been given a preliminary report. It seems likely that they would be sent to Buk Chang, also known as Camp 18.
Why is that?
Asked Real.
Blue Man answered, Buk Chang is operated by the Interior Ministry rather than the National Security people. It's less brutal and prisoners there have more privileges. Some can even be re-educated and given their freedom.
Roby said, But why do you think they would be sent there, then? Pak was a traitor. I'm sure they will want to take that out on his family. No second chances for them.
Honor and loyalty run deep over there, especially in the military, replied Blue Man. Pak undoubtedly had friends of high rank.
The president nodded.
I can see that. And it's not simply being kind to the children of a fallen friend, added Blue Man. It's for their own sakes.
How do you mean?
Some of the generals probably believe he was railroaded. They might worry that they might be next. Thus, they want to establish a precedent that will allow their families or themselves to be sent to Buk Chang if they find themselves on the wrong end of a treason charge. In North Korea, you have to think five steps ahead if you want to survive, particularly at that level, because alliances change swiftly. Cassian mulled this over and nodded.
I think you're right, but we need to verify that they are indeed in this Buk Chang place.
He glanced at Blue Man, who said, That will be difficult, but we will get every resource on it, sir.
He paused.
So you really want to extract Pak's children from the camp?
Cassian drew a long breath and wouldn't meet Blue Man's eye.
I think that's what I said, he replied brusquely.
A minute of silence went by.
Finally, Blue Man said, That has never been done before, sir.
Never.
I'm aware of that, replied Cassian, now looking directly at him. Any ideas?
Surprisingly, it was Real who answered.
Well, I think we might turn to the handful of folks who have escaped from North Korean labor camps and who are in this country. I think one or more of them might have gotten out of Buk Chang. If so, they can tell us how they did it. We don't want to reinvent the wheel if we don't have to.
Cassian looked impressed. An excellent suggestion.
He looked at Blue Man.
What sort of team would be required?
Blue Man said,
Few in number and the best we have, but still, I don't see how it can be done. This is North Korea.
Roby said, I thought our being here meant you wanted us involved, Mr. President.
Cassian looked at him guiltily.
I realize I'm your commander-in-chief, Agent Roby, but after what you've both been through, what was Syria and now Pak, I'm reluctant to call on you again.
Real spoke up.
What if we volunteer?
Blue Man looked at her oddly.
Roby kept his gaze on the president.
Cassian said, Are you volunteering?
Yes,
said Real.
And Roby nodded.
That is quite courageous of you, said Cassian.
Actually, it's our job.
The president looked at Real and then at Roby. Thank you, he said. You have no idea what this means to me.
I think we do,
said Real.
After Cassian left the room for his flight on Air Force One, Roby looked at Blue Man.
Can we meet with someone who escaped from Buk Chang?
I think we can arrange that, yes. But you realize this is a suicide mission, don't you?
A couple of American agents going into a North Korean labor camp and extracting two highly valued political prisoners?
Said Real, her eyebrows hiked.
Walk in the park.
Capture equals death, said Blue Man.
Oh, worse, said Roby.
How?
Said Real.
They could chuck us into the camp for the rest of our lives. He looked at Blue Man. And I would assume that all knowledge of any connection to an official mission on behalf of the United States would be disavowed.
I think we can safely assume that, said Blue Man.
Well, it's nice to know where we all stand,
said Real, dryly. Chapter 55. It had taken the better part of 2 weeks, but Chung Cha had rinsed Ben off once more in the shower and beheld a girl devoid of dirt, even in her ears. And the stubborn grime under her fingernails and toenails was no more. The medical visits had been conducted, and Min's wounds and bruises had been attended to and were healing quickly. The girl's overall health had been pronounced sound, and her immune system was functioning properly. That was truly a miracle, Chung Cha knew, for a camp prisoner of any duration, because the conditions were so squalid. As on a battlefield, far more died from disease than wounds. Bacteria easily trumped bombs and bullets in lethality. Men's teeth were in poor condition, but unlike Chung Cha's, they were capable of largely being saved. The girl had not flinched once at the dentist's office. She seemed to understand that all that was being done was for her own good. Chung Cha had increased the girl's meal intake slowly, giving Min more and diverse food each day until her stomach could handle it properly. The doctors had told her that Min had not reached her growth spurt yet, and the additional food would help accelerate this event. There was the matter of education, which for now Chung Cha took on herself. Min was an eager if frustrated learner, and the hours of instruction went by quickly. She could read a bit, and she knew her numbers to a point. She was well-versed, as all prisoners were, in the philosophy and teachings of North Korea's great leaders. But she needed to know more than that. This could not be accomplished in a week or even a year, Chung Cha knew, as she was not a trained teacher. She would have to arrange for Min to attend school, but Min would be far behind other students her age, and to place her there now would only serve to humiliate her. So Chung Cha would work with her, and then she planned to arrange for a personal instructor. It would all take time and money, but Chung Cha had requested and received special dispensation to accomplish this. It was a wonder to her that she had never asked for such a thing before. Apparently the leadership was willing to give her far more than a rice cooker and some wands. As she spent time with Min, Chung Cha waited for a phone call or a knock on the door that would summon her to work. She knew it would come at some point. And when she had to go and train, as she did each day, Min was left with the family that managed the apartment building. At first, Min wanted to stay with Chung Cha, go wherever she was going. This was impossible, Chung Cha had explained to the girl. The first time she had to go away, Min was very upset, and Chung Cha knew why.
She doesn't believe I'm coming back.
Chung Cha had taken off a ring that she wore and given it to Min.
You take care of this for me while I'm gone. You can give it back to me when I return. It is my prized possession. Did it belong to someone in your family?
Min asked. Chung Cha lied and said,
My mother.
The ring was actually of no significance to her. It was just a ring. But a lie was as good as the truth when it achieved one's goal. One evening, Chung Cha dressed Min in her nicest clothes, and they walked to the metro. At first, Min was afraid to get on the train. But Chung Cha told her it was a fun ride that would take them to a place where a great meal would be waiting. Min jumped on the train without hesitation. She looked around in amazement, both at all the people on the train and how fast it moved. When they got off and ascended to street level, she wanted to know if they would take this train thing back home. Chung Cha assured her that they would, which made Min smile. They walked past a number of restaurants. While Min looked curiously at them, Chung Cha kept her gaze straight ahead. Then she led Min into the Sam Tai Sung hamburger restaurant. They sat at a table. Chang-cha kept her back to the wall. She was surprised when Min noticed this and said,
"You don't like people coming up behind you, do you? Do you? No, but they do anyway. Then you must do something about that."
They ate hamburgers and fries. Chang-cha let Min have only a few sips of her vanilla milkshake because she was worried the richness might make her sick. Min's eyes widened.
"This is the best food I ever had."
"It is not Korean food."
"Where, then?"
"Just not Korean."
They finished eating and left. Chang-cha and Min walked around Pyongyang, and she showed the young girl as many of the sights as possible in a few hours. Min had innumerable questions, and Chang-cha tried to answer them all as best she could.
"Is the Supreme Leader really 3 meters tall?"
"I have never met him, so I do not know."
"They say he is the strongest person on earth, and his mind is full of all the knowledge in the world."
"They said the same to me about his father."
They walked on in silence for a bit.
"You said you had no family at the camp,"
began Chang-cha.
"I have no family."
"You were born in the camp, Min. You had to have a family."
"If I did, no one told me who they were."
"They separated you from your mother?"
Min shrugged.
"I have always been alone there. That is just the way it was."
She looked up at Chang-cha.
"What about your family?"
She nudged the ring on Chang-cha's finger.
"Your mother gave you this?"
Chang-cha did not answer. They walked on in silence. After they returned on the train to the apartment, Chang-cha settled Min into her bed on the sofa. Min studied her quietly.
"Did I say something to make you sad, Chun-cha?"
"You did nothing wrong. The wrong is all within me. Go to sleep."
Chang-cha went to her room, undressed, and climbed into the bed. She lay there, staring at the ceiling. And on that ceiling there appeared images she had forced from her mind seemingly forever. The guards had come for her that day. General Pak had told her that she could be free. Then Pak had left. And the woman had taken Chang-cha aside and told her what she must do to earn her freedom.
"Your mother and father are enemies of our country. Your brothers and sisters' minds have been poisoned as well, Chang-cha. You understand this, do you not?"
Chang-cha had slowly nodded. She could not remember loving her parents. They regularly beat her, even when not instructed to by the guards. They snitched on her. Her brother and sister were competitors of hers for food, clothing. They too snitched on her. They too beat her. She did not love them. They were evil. She assumed they had always been evil. She was here because of her family. She had done nothing wrong. It was they who had committed the wrongs.
"Then you must act, Chang-cha. You must rid your country of its enemies. Then you will be free."
"But how do I do this?"
she had asked.
"I will show you. You must do it now."
She had been taken to a room underneath the prison. It was in the same area where she had lived for a while because of something her father had done while there. It was far worse than living in the hut. She could not believe that anything could be worse than that, but it had been. During that time, she had not seen the sun for what seemed like years. All of her work was done underground, digging with a pickaxe, hauling rock, working her fingers literally down to the bone. Inside this room were four people. They were tied to posts. Their heads were covered with hoods. Their mouths must have been gagged underneath, because all Chang-cha could hear were grunts and moans. There were two guards on either side of the four people. The woman had taken a knife from her bag. It was long, curved, and had a serrated edge. She handed it to Chang-cha.
"Do you see the red circle drawn on their fronts?"
Chang-cha looked over and indeed saw a red circle on the chest of each of the four people.
"You will stick this knife inside the red circle. You will then pull it out and stick it back in.
This is for each of the people, do you understand?
Chung Cha said,
Is this my family?
The woman said,
Do you want to be free of this place?
Chung Cha nodded vigorously.
Then you do not question. You follow orders. This is your order. Do it now, or you will die here as an old woman.
Chung Cha gripped the knife and walked hesitantly toward the bound figure on the far left. The one she assumed must be her father. He was struggling against his binding, perhaps knowing what was coming. She heard his grunts increase in volume. He thrashed, but he could not really move because of the bindings and the stoutness of the wooden post. Chung Cha raised the knife as high as she could, over her head. She drew it back. The grunts increased. But for the gag, her father would be screaming. She screwed up her eyes until she could barely see out of them, and she lunged forward and plunged the knife into the circle. His body went rigid, and then he thrashed madly, nearly dislodging the knife from her grasp.
Once more,
screamed the woman. Chung Cha withdrew the knife and stuck it in him again. Then he stopped moving as the blood poured down his front. A guard stepped forward and removed the hood. It was her father. His face hung down, the gag balled in his mouth. His eyes were open, lifeless. He seemed to be staring down at her.
The next one, Chung Cha. Do it or you are lost,
screamed the woman. Chung Cha automatically turned to the next person and stabbed twice. It was her sister.
Do it now, Chung Cha. Now, or you are lost forever.
The next, it was her brother. The woman screamed the threat again and again.
Do it now, Chung Cha, now, or you are lost forever.
The last two strikes, metal thudded into flesh. Chung Cha no longer had any idea what she was doing. Her hand was moving of its own accord. She could have been stabbing a dead hog. When the hood was taken off, her dead mother looked down at her. Chung Cha dropped the knife, took a step back, and fell to the floor, crying, her body covered with the blood of her family. Then she picked up the knife and tried to kill herself with it, but the guards were too fast. They took it from her. The woman pulled her up.
You have done well. Now you can leave here and serve your country forever. You have done well, Chung Cha. You should be so proud.
Chung Cha looked at the woman. She was smiling down at the little girl who had just slaughtered her family. Chung Cha did not know that she was crying in her bed now. But she did know that Min had climbed in with her, wrapped her little body around her, and was hugging her tightly. Chung Cha could not hug her back. Not now. On the ceiling was the image of her family, dead by her hand. All dead. The price of her freedom? Chung Cha's soul. Chapter 56. His name was Kim Sook. He had escaped from Buck Chang many years before. Sook had been extremely cooperative in helping Roby and Real learn about his harrowing flight from the labor camp. He had escaped at age 18. He was now nearly 30. He had been imprisoned as a hostage with his family for his father's alleged crimes against the state. He and a friend, a young man a year older, had planned the escape for months. They had received information from two other prisoners who had escaped, but had returned to the camp after their recapture in China. They had come back from a work detail outside of the gates. They had dispersed to go back to their huts. The guards had been lackadaisical, Sook said. They had not counted correctly or paid enough attention to where the workers had gone off to. He and his friend had hurried away toward their respective huts. But it was a busy time of the day with many people moving about and few guards to watch over them. Sook and his friend had gone to a place where they had hidden old woolen sacks they had collected over time. They waited until dark. It would be madness to attempt escape during light, Sook said. Then they wrapped themselves in the woolen sacks, trying to cover their heads and their hands especially.
They crept toward an unguarded section of the fence. They had observed the patrols of the guards outside the gates and waited for a unit of them to pass by. Then they would have a half hour to make their escape. They used a long board they had hidden near the fence to pry apart the electrified wires. Sook said he could feel the current moving through the board and into him, but the wraps around his hands seemed to be working. His friend slipped through the opening in the fence. Then Sook passed the board between the wires, and the friend made a gap for him, and he slipped through. One of the wires grazed his shoulder, and he could feel the jolt of current and smell his skin burning. He had opened his shirt and let Roby and Reel see the scar. "I was lucky," he said. "One man who attempted escape this way 2 years before got caught in the wires and was electrocuted." Then both men had run. They ran for miles, following the road at first, then a path, and then they simply ran between trees in the surrounding forest. That had been the beginning of their long journey, a journey that included stealing clothes and food, bribing border guards with cigarettes, nearly being captured several times, and posing as workers in search of paying labor. Fortunately for them, there were millions of North Koreans looking for work, and it was possible for them to become lost in such a multitude. "It was still very difficult," said Sook. "We nearly starved. We were very nearly shot. We finally made it to China. I worked my way westward into India. I saved my money for 2 years, and then with help, I flew to France. From there, I came to America. I have been here ever since."
"And your friend?"
Real asked. "I do not know. Once we were in China, we parted ways. We thought if we stayed together, it would invite suspicion. I hope he made it to the West, but I do not know." He looked at Roby and Reel. "So you propose to rescue these people from Buck Chang?"
"Yes."
"You will not succeed."
"Why?" asked Roby.
"It may be easier than many believe to escape from the camp itself. There are far more prisoners than guards. It is like a handful of men trying to corral a small city. There are many holes, many ways out. They control the population through fear and the snitching of other prisoners. In that way, they have many more eyes looking out for problems."
"Okay. And your point?"
"The real challenge begins after you escape the camp. You have to blend in. There are bribes that must be made. You must show yourself to those who will have no loyalty. Now they may look the other way if you are North Korean. After all, you are simply filth trying to get by. You can do no real harm. They will let you pass for a few packs of cigarettes. It is done. You may or may not be recaptured. But the border guards will not suffer because of it."
"But if we don't look like them?" said Roby.
"You obviously are American. When you open your mouths, you will sound like Americans. You are the evil. They will never let you pass, I am sorry."
"We won't have to go through the border, Sook. We have other resources, ones you didn't have."
"But still, I will tell you, even with all your resources, they will not let you pass. They will capture you."
Roby looked at Reel. Reel turned back to Sook.
"Can you think of some way that we could manage it?"
Sook sat back in his chair and considered her question. "Perhaps if you had a North Korean with you."
"I'm pretty sure we don't have any in our agency," said Roby.
"I will do it," said Sook.
Roby and Reel exchanged surprised glances.
"You'd risk going back to a labor camp in North Korea to help people you don't even know?"
"I may not know them, but I know what will happen to them in there. That's enough for me. Let me help you."
"That's not our call, Sook, though we appreciate it," said Roby. "We'll have to run it by our superiors."
"Then do so," he replied, "because without someone like me, you don't stand a chance."
Blue Man was for it. Evan Tucker and Josh Potter were against it. President Cassian approved it. That negated the two votes against.
The president trumped everyone except the collective will of the voters at the ballot box every 4 years. National geospatial analysts had zeroed in on Buck Chang with their satellite eyes, and what they reported back, coupled with the results of other intelligence assets, had confirmed that the adopted son and daughter of General Pak were there. They even knew which hut they were living in, and that four guards surrounded the hut. There was also another intelligence success. General Pak had powerful friends in North Korea. One of them had managed to arrange for a coded message to be sent to the son and daughter in the camp. They would know that help would be coming. It took another week to prep the mission. Every detail was gone over 100 times, and every contingency as well in case something went wrong, which they knew was not unlikely. North Korea was perhaps the toughest challenge Robie and Real had yet faced. The country was hard to get into, and even more difficult to get out of. It had millions of soldiers and a paranoid citizenry well-versed in spying on each other. The terrain was difficult, the language and cultural barriers immense, and the country was located in a part of the world where, other than South Korea, the United States had few allies. They spent a week at the burner box, doing intense field work in preparation. The rugged mountains of western North Carolina stood in for the ones they would face at Buck Chang. A mock-up of the prison and the targeted hut was constructed at the facility. During the first few exercises, Robie, Real, and Sook were shot dead. They had made great strides since, but none of them knew if it would be enough when they tried it for real. The route in and out of the target would be unusual. As Sook had told them, prisoners escaping from Buck Chang invariably headed north toward China, whose long border with North Korea was not very far away. They would not be heading north. Too many things could go wrong, particularly with two obvious Westerners in tow. They all hoped that their out-of-the-box thinking would make it impossible for the North Koreans to follow them. The night before they were to leave, Robie and Real sat up late going over the plans one more time. "Do you think Sook will hold up?" he asked.
"He's done it before, Robie."
"Many years ago, and it might have been part luck."
"It might have been, but we're probably going to need some luck, too."
"I don't disagree with you. We have to keep our heads down, literally."
"But we're the guardian angels. If we have to fight our way out, we're going to have to do it."
"I know."
"I wonder if the president has considered the long game on this."
"You mean we snatched the traitor's family out from under the North Koreans?"
"Yep. If they were going to possibly come after us before, they're sure as hell going to come after us if we pull this off."
"He was pretty emotional about all this, so maybe he didn't really think it through. But that's not our call, Jessica. We're just the muscle in the field."
"Yeah, well, maybe the brains should follow the muscle's advice sometimes."
"I don't see that happening. Too many egos involved."
"Seriously, though, Robie, the North Koreans have nukes, and they're crazy enough to use them. We pull this off, they'll feel like they've lost all face. They are not going to turn the other cheek. A successful mission here might just prove to be the catalyst for Armageddon."
"Which means a lot of poor, innocent people will die because their leadership felt disrespected."
"Which pretty much happens in every war ever fought."
"But this won't be war. It'll be annihilation."
"You want to refuse the mission?"
Robie shook his head. "No, I'll do the mission. I just want both of us to understand the possible outcomes."
"I understand them very clearly. And at least the president, with all his faulty logic, is trying to make things right after what happened with Pak. I have to admire that."
"So let's go do this thing," said Robie. Chapter 57. They flew to China and traveled to the coast by puddle jumper. From there, they took a boat across Korea Bay at night and landed at the end of a small inlet that cut deeply into the North Korean coastline. The closest town was Anju. Buk Chang was roughly 50 miles due east from their location. There were just three of them, Robie, Real, and Kim Sook. They were all dressed in black, their faces also blackened.
Roby and Reel were heavily armed and had state-of-the-art communication gear. They hoped to be able to use it at some point to later rendezvous with their support team. Roby looked at Kim Sook as they tied down their high-performance, rigid-hulled, inflatable boat. The RIB could reach speeds of over 50 knots using relatively quiet engines. "You ready?" Roby asked.
"Little late for that," said Sook.
"Just checking." They had maps and directions loaded on electronic devices attached to their wrists like watches. Above them, an American satellite was feeding them details about what lay ahead. In their earwigs, a constant stream of intelligence info was being sent. Stealth was critical here, but so was speed. They had a long distance to cover, and they needed to get there and back while it was still dark. That would be impossible on foot. So they had something else. Three small scooters powered by batteries which ran very quietly. There were also pedals that helped to recharge the batteries. With night vision optics, they could see in the dark. Roby went first. Sook took the middle, and Reel brought up the rear. They stuck to the road as far as they dared, then went off-road as they drew closer to the camp. Buck Chang was in the middle of nowhere, so they would not have to navigate a city or any sort of populated area before reaching it. You didn't build concentration camps among millions of people. They encountered no problems on the trip. The satellite gave them a clear line to the camp. The intelligence chatter updated them on recent developments. Duho and Eon's son, Pak's adopted son and daughter, were being held in a hut near the back of the camp. Unlike other prisoners who were lumped 50 to a hut, the Paks were being held by themselves with special guards. But having only two prisoners in the hut didn't make it easier for the rescue attempt. It made it more difficult. The other huts were not individually guarded. Apparently, the North Koreans anticipated trouble securing Pak's children. It had been confirmed that a coded message had been passed to Duho and Eon's son. They had not been told what night it would happen, because if that information had fallen into the wrong hands, it would have been disastrous. But the two would know that a rescue attempt was being made, and that they would have to be ready. When Roby, Reel, and Sook drew close to the camp, they dismounted from their scooters and hid them in a patch of trees. Sook changed his clothes, wiped off his face, and hoisted an old duffel bag over his shoulder. Now he looked like a typical North Korean peasant. He took to the road, while Roby and Reel paralleled his movements through the trees. The outer perimeter patrol of Buck Chang lay dead ahead. As Sook walked along, three guards approached him. They told him to stop and identify himself. He did so, telling him that he was traveling east to Hamhung to see his family and take a job there he had been promised. He gave them his paperwork, which had been expertly prepared. While two of them searched his duffel, the lead guard examined the paperwork. He finally handed it back.
"You are near Buck Chang camp."
He pointed to the north.
"You must head that way. There is a road that will take you around the camp, and then you can head east."
He suddenly eyed Sook suspiciously.
"What sort of job are you going to do in Hamhung?"
"Farming."
"Let me see your hands."
Sook held them up. They were roughened and calloused. He had spent a week making them so. The guard nodded.
"Then go work your ox and smell your horse shit," he said.
And the other guards laughed. They stopped laughing when three rounds from suppressed weapons entered their bodies, dropping them where they stood. Roby and Reel emerged from the woods and dragged the bodies into the cover of the trees. Roby slipped off one of the guards' walkie-talkies and handed it to Sook so he could listen in on local communications. They moved on and soon reached the rear outer fence of the camp. They had been given the patrol times of the guards and waited for four of them to pass by before moving closer to the fence. They knew it was electrified and had come prepared for that. Using a laser, Reel cut through enough strands to allow a good-sized hole that each of them could slip through.
Sook went first, followed by Reel and then Roby. The hut they wanted was at the very back of the camp. As they crept forward, they saw a burst of light and then realized it was a guard lighting a cigarette. Reel and Roby circled the hut, counting off the number of guards surrounding it. 4. Like the intel had said. Then they separated. Reel went left, and Roby and Sook went right. Reel spoke into the headset to Roby. He listened and said, "Affirmative. 3 count on second-hand sweep at 12. He pulled 2 tranquilizer pistols from holsters and aimed each at a different guard. Now that they were inside the camp, they didn't want to make any unnecessary noise. Based on the satellite reports and intelligence on the ground, they each carried 2 dart guns for a total of 4 shots, equaling the number of anticipated guards. Fortunately, that number had not changed. On the other side of the hut, Reel was doing the same. It was more difficult than it looked, aiming 2 guns simultaneously at 2 different targets, but they had no choice. Dropping less than all 4 guards with the first volley would allow the others to react and shoot back. The entire camp would be alerted. They each looked at their watches until the second hand hit 12. Then they took double aim, counted 3 Mississippi in their heads, and fired both weapons. 4 men fell. Sook rushed forward and into the hut. Roby and Reel were right on his 6. Duho and Ian's son were not asleep and were dressed in their work clothes. Sook explained to them who their rescuers were and what they were about to do. They asked no questions, but merely nodded and followed them out. They were through the hole in the fence and had fled down a path toward the woods when it happened. A siren went off. As they looked back, lights in the camp blazed on, and they heard feet rushing and motors starting. Roby pointed up an embankment. "This way, now." They ran up the embankment. Luckily, Duho and Un's son were young and in good shape. They had no difficulty keeping up. Also, no doubt, energized by the realization that if they were caught, they would be executed. As Roby and Reel rushed along, she said,
"Do you think we were set up?"
Sook answered, "I just heard on the walkie-talkie. The guards you shot on the perimeter were found." "Great," said Roby. "Let's double time it." "This way," said Sook, pointing to his left. "It's a shortcut to where we left the scooters." The 5 fled along the dark road. Roby kept a hand on Duho and guided him along using his night optics, while Reel did the same with Eon's son. They reached the scooters, and Eon's son climbed on with Reel, while Duho boarded Roby's. They hurtled down a path toward the road. Looking behind her, Reel saw headlights on the road. She spoke into her headset, telling Roby of the bogeys coming. Roby stopped his scooter and got Duho to climb on with Sook.
"Good luck,"
Reel told him. "If I'm not back in 2 minutes after you reach the RIB, go. Don't wait for me." They set off, and Roby doubled back, carrying a weapon over his shoulder. He knelt down on a knoll overlooking the road, took aim, and fired. The RPG round hit the lead truck right in the radiator. It exploded, sending debris hundreds of feet into the air. It also did something else. It effectively blocked the road. But the firing of the RPG had revealed his position, and bullets started flying at Roby from other trucks. He loaded in another rocket, took aim, and fired at the second truck, even as a round thudded into his chest and knocked him on his ass. The second truck blew up, and Roby heard the screams of men who were probably torn apart or burning to death. He looked down at his chest, where the round had nearly gone through his armored vest. He could feel the bruise on his sternum. It felt like he'd been hit by a car. He rose and picked up his rifle. There were 2 more trucks back there, but they couldn't get through the obstruction formed by the pair of destroyed vehicles. The troops were running past the flames and firing at his position. Roby readied his auto rifle, set out the bipod's support legs, got in a prone position, exhaled a long breath, nestled his chin against the weapon stock, sighted through the night scope, took aim, and fired. And he kept firing, acquiring a target and pulling the trigger, acquiring another target and pulling the trigger. He could have been on a firing range calmly mowing down paper targets, except that here, men were shooting back at him. Bullets whipped all around him, but he had the high ground, and he kept firing. And with each shot, a man died. As he ran out of ammo, the first mortar round exploded barely 50 feet from him, shaking the earth so violently that his rifle fell over and his face was driven into the dirt. The next round fired, he knew would be closer. He couldn't stay here any longer. The only thing he could do in the face of superior fire and manpower was retreat. He ran back to his scooter and climbed on. With only one person on it, the scooter's speed was much improved. He zoomed down the path, then veered left and down the embankment and onto the road. He wound the scooter up to its very top speed while shots whizzed past him. He rode for about 5 minutes, putting as much distance between him and his pursuers as possible. He realized he was not yet out of range of the mortar when a round struck ahead of him, lighting the night sky like a million candles. He had to cut the scooter sharply to the right and up an embankment to avoid being hit by debris. He flung himself off the scooter as another mortar round hit less than 20 feet from him. The impact again shook the earth, and the concussive force of the explosion sent him tumbling painfully along the rough terrain. When he rose, covered in dirt, a pain stabbed through his leg. He felt around his thigh, and his hand came away wet and reddened. When he hustled back and looked down at the scooter, his spirit sank. The front wheel was shattered. He looked up ahead of him, still miles and miles to go. It would take him forever on foot. The boat would be long gone. He looked behind him. They were still coming. Well, Roby thought, this is it. But he wouldn't go down without a fight. He pulled the pistols from their holsters and made sure they were fully loaded. He started running, but his bad leg made it difficult. Still, everything about his job was difficult, so he forced the pain from his mind and just sucked it up. He had covered about 2 painful miles when he heard it. The whomp whomp was a familiar sound to him. The North Koreans had called in air support. Well, that was smart, and also the end of the road for him. He looked to the sky and saw the darkened silhouette of the chopper. There were no running lights of the bird, and he wondered why. He expected a searchlight to start probing the ground for his location. Instead, his earwig crackled.
Agent Roby, this is Lieutenant Commander Jordan Nelson of the United States Navy in the chopper. We understand you might need some assistance.
That's a roger.
We've been tracking you via the electronic location signal you're wearing, but can you give us your precise coordinates, sir?
Roby looked at the illuminated device on his wrist and reeled off his exact position to Nelson. The chopper immediately circled and then came down closer to the ground in an opening among the trees. Nelson's voice came on the earwig again.
Afraid you're going to have to make a skid grab, sir. We can't land properly here.
On my way. Roby hustled across the open ground to where the chopper was hovering about 6 feet off the dirt. Nelson's voice said warningly,
"You've got bogeys on your 6 and 4 at 10 meters. We have to go, sir, right now."
The North Koreans had made up a lot of ground. Maybe they had moved the trucks and gotten vehicles through. And now the chopper was acting like a beacon for them. None of it was good. Bad wheel and all, Roby ran like he had never had before. This was his absolute last chance. 3 feet from the chopper, with incoming fire slicing through the air, he jumped, and his hand smacked against the left skid of the bird. He immediately